everybody. Welcome to the Wrestling Archives Podcast. I'm your co-host, Tim Hackman.
And I'm Rich Sigwald.
Welcome to the show. We are excited to get into a WrestleMania with you this time. If you've been listening for a while, if you have, thank you. We appreciate you hanging on. But you know that we started out doing all the WrestleManias in order. And next up is WrestleMania 30. And I think with WrestleMania 40 coming down the pike, if we thought it'd be a good time to jump back and work on some more of the WrestleManias in sequence. We're also going to have WrestleMania 40 preview episode coming up real soon, so keep an eye out for that. We'll give all of our amazing picks and prognostications that I'm sure will all be 100% correct.
Absolutely. We have an amazing track record.
We really do. We do great. Take it to Vegas, folks. Take it to Vegas. But yeah, anyway, and then we're going to do an older Royal Rumble, I think, and we got hopefully some special guest stars in the works for you. But we're always here to have a good time, so hope you're checking us out, WrestlingArchives.com, all the social medias and all the rest. So Rich, we're up to WrestleMania 30, coming to you live from the New Orleans Mercedes-Benz Superdome, not to be confused with the Silver Dome. April 6, 2014, attendance somewhere in the 60 to 65,000 people range and a pay-per-view buy rate of 690,000 with a tagline of "Let the good times roll, laissez les bons temps rouler," as they say down there. What 2014, what do you remember where you were and what you were doing?
Well, let's see, April 2014, my now wife and I had been dating at that point for 6 or 7 months.
Okay.
We were approaching moving in together at that point to an apartment in Owings Mills, Maryland, and just going through the whole weirdness of that process because nothing with us ever can go normal. So, it was a fascinating time. I was still a public librarian.
Ah, yes.
And just about starting to hate it at that point.
How long had you been in the public library side at that point?
Let's see. Actually working in a library branch since 2006 at that point. So 8 years.
Okay. Oh, yeah. That sounds about right. That's past the sell-by date for sure.
Yeah, I was in library school, and library school was opening my eyes to how much my library system is basically like the McDonald's of a restaurant. So, like, I would compare it to, like, you know, you go and have a hamburger at, like, a normal restaurant, and then you go have a hamburger at McDonald's. And they're nowhere close to being the same food, except for on very, very primitive principle that there is a bun and there is a beef product in between the bun. But you go to a restaurant where you sit down and people come bring you things, and it's a thick, juicy, real beef most of the time. But then you go to McDonald's and it's just a skimmed down, stripped down version, simplified, made to just shove in your pie hole and get out the door.
Kind of
experience with the public library.
You can read all about it in Rich's new article, "The McDonald's of Public Libraries: My Time in a Branch." 2014, I was a year and a half into my first library management role, and mostly feeling a little more comfortable by that time. I was trying to remember 2014. That seems so long ago. Anyway, I was trying to remember if we had any trips or anything that year, but that's fruitless to try to recreate that at this point.
I'm just going to take a peek at, like, here's the top songs of 2014.
Okay, let's hear it.
Fun to look at. So the number one song was Happy by Pharrell Williams. We all know that one. And there's also Dark Horse by Katy Perry with Juicy J. All of Me by John Legend. Let's see. Oh, All About That Bass by Meghan Trainor. I love that song.
That's a good song.
Yeah, came out that year. Let's see any... Oh, Let It Go from Frozen.
Okay.
Every child's Love Affair song and every parent's nightmare.
I've heard of that song. I don't think I've ever actually heard that song. Yeah. I'm really happy about it. So
you should be happy about that.
Don't ruin it for me.
Let's see. Boom Clap by Charlie XCX. Mm-hmm. And Wrecking Ball by Miley Cyrus came out that year.
That's a good fucking song.
Yeah. And Radioactive by Imagine Dragons.
Mm.
So, yeah. I mean, it's a decent year in music, I think, happening.
Yeah, it's not so bad. It's better than I expected, actually.
Yeah.
That Pharrell Williams guy is from here. He does a bunch of stuff around Virginia Beach and Portsmouth and such because this is his home.
Very cool.
Yeah. Anyway, so yeah, this is coming to us from New Orleans, a town I love, a town I'm going back to actually here in a month or so. We're going in May with some friends. We haven't been since 2017, I think, was the last time we went.
Was that again, a library conference?
Nope, just actually, you know what it was? Is our dog Smokey had died, and we're like, we got to get the fuck out of this house for a little while because it's too depressing. So we went to New Orleans, and it was fun. We had a great time. Like, it's a fantastic city. The problem was every time I got to pet like a dog on the street, like I'd almost start crying. So like that part was a little rough. But anyway, so they start out with a New Orleans kind of typical second line band in front of Preservation Hall on a dark and NOLA street. It's a little
terrible.
Terrible. Yeah, I was gonna say what's the word? Stereotypical, highly processed.
Yeah, because it's synthesized music. It's not even like the actual brass band playing. I'm sure it possibly would have probably cost about the same amount to get the actual Preservation Hall jazz band to just play in the opening. Like, what are you doing? Like,
pick up one of the literally hundreds of like second line bands available around New Orleans for like pennies, you know.
That would have required them to probably go into like the lower ninth ward or something like that, and nobody wants to do that.
They could have hired like 10 of those bands and put them together. That would have been incredible.
Yeah, that would have been awesome.
Spread some money around.
But, and actually help the, you know, local economy with that.
Yeah,
but
no. Seriously.
Yeah, the opening to this WrestleMania is terrible. I was like, oh boy, I am not looking forward to the rest of the show if this is how it goes.
It's a bit of a tourism video kind of thing there. And then they also kind of mix it in with a trip down memory lane of WrestleManias because this is, you know, it's a decade. This is not the 30th anniversary of WrestleMania, no matter what they say, because there's no year zero. This is the 29th. This is, stop lying to us, WrestleMania. Stop it. They're going to do it again in a couple weeks. They're going to tell us.
Yes, they are. Yes, they are.
It's the 40th anniversary of WrestleMania, and they're full of shit. Don't believe them, folks.
Yes, they are. Yeah, and the weird thing about the flashbacks of WrestleMania's past was that they were like superimposing them poorly into the video to make it look like they were on like Mardi Gras floats or whatever.
Yeah,
and it's just, this is cheesy as hell. Who the hell? What? No, this doesn't make sense.
Well, speaking of people who are full of shit, we get the host of WrestleMania 30, which is Hulk Hogan, introduced to the ring, and he says, "Welcome to the Silver Dome," at least twice before somebody corrects him. I don't know if they got him on the earphone or what.
Stone Cold told him.
Oh, that's right. What it looks like he should have come out and called him a dumb son of a bitch. Is what he should have done.
Yeah.
But yes, this is also kind of terrible.
Yeah, so we don't have like any of the traditional WrestleMania openings of like a salute to the troops or a national anthem or America the Beautiful. Just Rick Derringer greeting us out with Hulk Hogan's theme music, and Hulk Hogan comes out with his feather boa, and this is like, and then Stone Cold interrupts him, and then The Rock comes out, and folks, this goes on for 20 minutes. It's 20 minutes of these two just these three people trading lines and just being horrible. It's just not a pleasant opening, and
it's a mutual appreciation circle jerk.
Yeah.
Everybody's having a good time. Everybody's glad to be there. Everybody's impressed with how much of a legend everybody else is. They all do their catchphrases. Hulkamania's running wild and Stone Cold's, what does he say? He's, give me a hell yeah, maybe?
Give me a hell yeah, that's the bottom line. Yeah. Stone Cold said so. What? And you Rock, can tell we're not enthusiastic about this at all.
Like, and The Rock is cooking something, of course. It's probably probably jambalaya, maybe with some crawfishes in there. Anyway.
Some crawdads.
I love crawfish. Do you like crawfish?
No.
They're a lot of work for not much meat, but they are tasty.
That's my issue. I'm lazy.
Yeah.
So.
Anyway. So, commentary. Michael Cole, Jerry Lawler, and Bradshaw, JBL, are on the mic for this one. Usual guys on the Spanish announce table.
With an addition over there, Ricardo Rodriguez has joined the team over there.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
Brought the French team in, too. The French announcers are also there.
But this is, that's not Rougeau, right? It used to be Rougeau.
No.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's Christophe Agu and Philippe Chereau. Hmm.
Sure.
Whoever they were. Okay.
You say so. Yeah.
Yep.
They're really good at whatever that is they do. So there's a dark match that we get to miss, thank God. But the Usos, Jimmy and Jay, defeated Los Matadors, which was Diego and Fernando, with El Torito. It's my favorite snack food. Versus the Real Americans, which is Cesaro and Jack Swagger, with Zeb Coulter. And Rybacksel, which was Curtis Axel and Ryback. So just be thankful that that's not on the video. It was a Fatal 4 elimination match for the WWE Tag Team Championship. Like I said, the Usos won and took the belt there. And we can all just go on with our lives.
Yeah, look how the WWE values Tag Team Championships by putting... put it, one, in a Fatal 4-way elimination match, and two, it's on the free part of the show.
Yeah. And from there, we roll right into a video package for Daniel Bryan. So this is, like, this is the culmination of that whole Daniel Bryan, like, social media fan push, basically, right? Like,
yeah.
He was, kind of small, kind of technical, not a typical superstar-looking guy, and the fans just, like, decided they liked this guy. They liked shouting yes, and he was going to be their guy, goddammit. And I will say that I think this is why wrestling is so endlessly fascinating to me, honestly. Like, so they make the fan reaction part of the story, and then Triple H and Stephanie sort of play the part of, like, the evil corporate overlords who are out to thwart the fans' wishes at all costs, right? And make sure that Daniel Bryan doesn't get over, you know? And so it turns it from a fan reaction or an angle into, like, a movement, almost. And now it's, like, an act of defiance to root for this guy, because, goddammit, corporate guy doesn't want him to be the champion. So we're here. We're going to make it happen just by sheer force of will.
Yeah, this is insanity.
It's fascinating. It's fucking... it's crazy.
the popularity that he has, it's on the level of Hulkamania, I wrote down. Like, it's you never see a wrestling crowd that you've unified in ever.
100%.
Since Hulk Hogan and Andre the Giant. Like, you never have seen that. Like, Hulk Hogan versus Ultimate Warrior had the crowd split. Rock versus Austin had the crowd split. But Daniel Bryan is pushing 100% support.
Yeah.
And that whole stadium, 65,000 people, are just shouting yes in unison, pointing at the sky doing it. It's a very intense moment.
Yeah.
Just to watch on TV. It had to be insane if you were in that arena. And just the concept that social media can suddenly influence storytelling this strongly is incredible, and a real shift in the wrestling dynamic too. That it showed that WWE wasn't necessarily completely in control anymore of who's good, who's bad, who's a fan favorite, who isn't. So they can't necessarily control that kind of stuff anymore. Like, I mean, it's always kind of been like, well, the promotion reacts to who's getting over with the crowd, but this is a little bit more than that. This is them not wanting to really initially acknowledge Daniel Bryan as a shoot, like a shoot, they didn't want to do it. And then suddenly he is so popular and so over, the company's held hostage to do it, basically.
Yeah, I'd love to read a history of this part of, you know, WWE's history one of these days, like with people who were in the room when they finally decided, like, look, what if we stop ignoring this and turn it into part of the show, you know? And it's again, it's what makes wrestling just endlessly fascinating for me, you know.
I think it's got layers, man. Yeah, it's got layers. Like, one of the things I was thinking about with this is that Daniel Bryan is so popular with them at this point because he's different.
Yeah.
He is not just some 6'7", 300-pound muscle meat man that can barely reach his own ass walking to the ring and standing there and pushing against another man that looks just like him.
Yeah.
Like, everybody else on this card looks the same. Like, Randy Orton, Triple H, John Cena, you know, Brock Lesnar. You know, these are all the guys that they want, and Batista, that they want to be, like, the main event top guys carrying the company.
Yeah.
And they all look the same. They all have the same body shape, the same personality, the same haircut. Like, it's ridiculous. And you have little tiny Daniel Bryan just
plugging away, and the crowd just, like, digging into it. I was going to say, this is 15, 16, 17, maybe more years after, say, WCW realized that they could win fans over with smaller guys, right? And creating the cruiserweight thing. Like,
yeah.
So this is not an unfamiliar concept, but again, it just kind of shows sort of maybe the inflexibility of the WWE mode of thinking about wrestling and their wrestling product, that they're just like, you know, wanted to kind of shut this down.
Right, and even, I mean, Vince notoriously would push back against Jim Ross, who's like, you need to sign Chris Jericho, you need to sign Chris Benoit, you need to sign, you know, like all that, you need to Eddie sign Guerrero. Eddie Guerrero. Yeah. And Vince is like, no, I don't think so. I don't think they can do
it. I don't see it. I don't see it, pal.
Right. They're all small, you know?
Yeah.
Comparatively small, you know? Like, if he could have just, like, cloned Brock Lesnar 20 times, that would have been his full roster. He just would have been happy with that.
Okay, so here's my question for you. So on this video package, we see Daniel Bryan, and he's like a clean-shaven and blue-eyed, like, serious baby face. He looks like an actual baby. And through the package, you can see him kind of evolve into this, like, bearded weirdo. And to be honest, I sort of prefer the clean-shaven kind of. Maybe this is just me being a little more conservative in that respect. But I get where they were going. Like, he's from, he's from the Northwest, right? And he's got hippie vibe almost, you know?
Yeah, maybe they were going for, like, the hipster thing with him. Yeah. Like, they're just like, you know, you were into him before it was cool to be into him kind of thing. Like, he watches wrestlers you've never heard of kind of thing.
He sees your bands before they release their first EP.
Right. So.
And then he doesn't listen to them anymore. He's like, oh, they totally sold out when they released that 4-song EP that they only sold out of the back of their van. That's when they really jumped it for me.
Yeah, he's WWE's Portlandia. He's artisanal wrestling. That's what Daniel Bryan is.
He's going to put a bird on it.
Right. You could pickle that. And people just love him. And the WWE was left with no choice but to acknowledge it. But then they turn it into a brilliant thing where he basically has to run the gauntlet to get a shot at the big guys.
Yeah. So in the course of the package, Triple H says he's just not good enough to succeed, which is, you know, just right to the heart, you know, just cut your guts out and leave you on the floor. All right, so let's get to this match. He comes out, like you said, everybody's chanting yes. On top of that, they've also given people these little, like, I don't know, what do you think those are, 8.5 by 11 white cards that just say yes on them, that they hold up when they chant, and it's a sea of them. It's just... it's unanimous. Stephanie introduces Triple H. This is the winner of this match will be included in the World Heavyweight Championship match later in the card. So that's what we're wrestling for here. Triple H's entrance takes forever. He's still stuck on this goddamn corny Conan the Barbarian thing where he's like sitting on a throne and he's got a mask and
It's Wagnerian.
I don't know what the fuck he's doing.
It's you're watching a Wagner opera. It's god awful. And it's Aryan almost. It's like the rise. It's Teutonic. Like it's so ridiculous. And it's bad. And like they introduce him as the King of Kings, and it's just like are you not aware of the biblical reference that like, you know,
are you saying you're Jesus?
Right. There's some Protestant strains that refer to Jesus as the King of Kings. Yeah. And before the Motorhead theme, he's got this like Carmina Burana kind of like rip-off choir thing singing. It's like, just pay the rights for a performance of Carmina Burana if you're going to do it. Just you got the fucking money. Just do it.
Yeah.
And then the Motorhead theme hits, which honestly is the best part of all of Triple H's stick here. But it's like, is he trying to outdo the Undertaker in pomp and circumstance? Like, what you doing, bro? And it just,
yeah,
it's bad.
Yeah. Brian comes out, you know, again to a sea of yes signs. He's his shoulders all taped up like he's the Colonial Army guy in that painting. And he skips the handshake and goes for a leg kick instead, which I thought was actually kind of a fun way to start the match. And so, again, I missed this whole stage of WWE. I didn't watch any of this the first time around. And so the first time I'd really seen him working is in when he came to AEW. And so what I learned like from watching this is that he's always kind of worked like a maniac. And he's lucky to have only 100 concussions instead of like 10,000 concussions. Because
yes,
he has zero regard for his own like just safety or even just basic conventions of working in a wrestling sense, you know?
Era of the smart mark at this point. The internet has definitely fully infiltrated the wrestling world, and WWE didn't quite know what to do with it. And this Yes campaign behind Daniel Bryan is just part of that. They kayfabe is completely destroyed at this point. And, you know, people know Daniel Bryan, I assume, from watching indie videos on YouTube. And, you know, you can't do a surprise debut or anything like that because it's someone, a good portion of the crowd, be like, oh yeah, I saw that guy wrestle on YouTube at a fire hall against some other guy, like I know him, I really like him. Like there's no surprise, they're not able to build and develop people very well anymore. And so WWE is kind of forced to just acknowledge the street cred. And that and Daniel Bryan is one of the first folks that they had to do that with. And this match is just blah, you know.
He beats himself up more than any opponent could. The way he just tosses his own body around. I'm like, dude, I'm surprised. Again, I'm surprised he can still walk. He gets a crossface on Triple H, and it's this big move. Triple H barely gets to the rope. He goes diving through the ropes a couple of times. Some big kicks to the chest where the crowd's chanting yes each time. I kind of like that part. Bryan gets the win. I don't remember what the actual finish was. I didn't.
Bryan catches him with the big knee and puts, and that's the pin. This match goes 26 minutes, and it took 35 minutes from the start of the telecast to the first bell of the match.
Sweet Jesus.
So it took an hour. It took an hour to get through the first match. And the ring is still wet from Stone Cold's beer. It's so bad. It's just, this is not a great way to kick off the show. But, mm-hmm. You know, the thing is that I don't think you could just drop Daniel Bryan into the triple threat main event without some sort of extra hurdle. It doesn't tell the story right. And so
right.
I give them kudos for booking this. Maybe shouldn't have been just up against Triple H, who was technically retired at this point, and coming back out to do this. Like, that doesn't make sense. It kind of gives away that Daniel Bryan's going to win. If you put someone else in there, maybe it would be a bit more of a surprise. The thing that I liked the most out of this match was Stephanie was on the outside definitely channeling her sensational Sherry, just screaming her head off, trying to get involved as much as possible without actually getting involved. It's some impressive work out of Stephanie McMahon on the outside of the ring.
Yeah, she's method acting here. She's snarling and she's getting into it. So that means Bryan gets to come back. It makes sense for his nemesis, you know, the boss, to be the guy that he has to beat to get through. But that's not really how, like, being the boss works. You're not like, well, I'm going to set up a challenge for you, and it's me. You know, you would, like, you would pick your strongest, best guy, or maybe two of them. Anyway, whatever. The next match is The Shield, which is Dean Ambrose, a.k.a. Jon Moxley. Yay. That was a sarcastic yay. Roman Reigns and Seth Rollins versus Kane and the New Age Outlaws, which is Billy Gunn and Road Dogg. This is a six-man tag match. I just will point out at the start that we just saw the New Age Outlaws on the 98 King of the Ring that we just watched, and this is 15 years later. And it looks like 15 years later for these guys.
And Kane, too.
And for Kane. Yeah.
Like, at first, they started introducing them, and the New Age Outlaws were getting booed, and I didn't understand what was happening because they showed absolutely nothing to set up this match. You had no idea what was going on. And honestly, I did watch this WrestleMania when it happened, but there's only one thing on this show that I remember, and you know, we'll get to it. I didn't understand what was happening, and then The Shield was coming out, and The Shield was one of those factions. So this is pretty much close to the end of me watching regularly. Just because, you know, I suddenly had a girlfriend and I was moving in with her.
Funny how that works.
Yeah. And also just the product was stale. Like, I mean, why are there's the New Age Outlaws and Kane? Like, no, thank you. I'm tired. And then, you know, like there's not, and then they hadn't really built anybody up. And like, I wasn't a big John Cena fan. So I just kind of drifted away from the product. I had already stopped watching SmackDown and was only watching Raw. And then I moved on.
Yeah.
But so like, I didn't understand The Shield. I didn't understand everybody's fascination with The Shield. I will say from this match, the only few takeaways I got is that it's very clear that Roman Reigns is a star in this match. He is outshining everybody in this. And I'm not saying that just because of like the bias towards the superstar that he's become, the mega superstar, but it's very clear that he is the one. He's the one that's going to get chosen out of that group to be something. And then Seth Rollins is behind that. And then at the time, Dean Ambrose is like, but like he was an indie darling, which is why everybody loved him. But he doesn't fit WWE at all.
No, I wrote the same thing down. I said Rollins and Roman are clearly stars here. And I said Ambrose/Moxley was always a fucking goofball, apparently. I missed The Shield. I remember people talking about it sort of positively. I even remember a couple people talking about, who must have been sort of smart fan type things, talking about, oh, this Dean Ambrose guy is really interesting. He's not, this isn't his milieu here. This is not a fit for him. And they beat up a couple of old men, actually, so I hope they feel good about themselves.
Yeah, they tear through the New Age Outlaws and Kane, like, no problem. And so the match ends with The Shield getting the New Age Outlaws up into, like, this weird powerbomb orgy of a thing. And JBL lands a most beautiful line that's 100 years of powerbomb right there. There goes the Attitude Era. The best thing to ever come out of JBL's mouth, and he could just shut up for the rest of the night after that.
Yeah, in fact, I would recommend it, actually.
Yeah.
So from there, we go backstage with Hacksaw Jim Duggan, Sergeant Slaughter, and Dangerous Danny Davis, who you may or may not remember him. He had a evil ref angle there for a little bit, playing with wrestling figures, so it's a commercial, basically. But then our boy Ricky Steamboat comes in a red gi, and he always looks amazing, and he could beat up everybody there. Ted DiBiase comes out and says everybody's got a price for the Million Dollar Man. Ron Simmons comes out and says, damn, and says... Who does he say that to? He says, I thought you were retired.
He just says it to everybody in general.
I just wrote down, this is insufferable.
Yeah. It's kind of cute. Yeah. But, one, I doubt the crowd recognized Dangerous Danny Davis or understood what was going on with him. You know, they know Hacksaw, kinda. They know Slaughter. Ricky Steamboat, they're just making a moron out of him at this point. Where he just comes out doing weird karate things. He's not fighting ninjas, or like he did in that one video, but...
But he could if he wanted to.
He could if he wanted to. It's also fascinating that at this point, like, when wrestlers retire, they are out of it long enough, they become faces.
Yeah.
Ted DiBiase was never a face.
Yeah, that's true.
At least when he was popular, he was never a face. Dangerous Danny Davis was never a face.
Yeah.
You know, and they just love him up. It's a fascinating little thing that happens in pro wrestling.
And we don't have to talk about it, but the Sergeant Slaughter biography on A&E is well worth your time.
It is.
Fascinating it is. Guy, amazing history in the business. It's worth it for learning about the back alley brawl with him and Pat Patterson, which I had never heard of before, from 1981, I think.
Yeah.
From Madison Square Garden. Absolutely incredible. Look that shit up on YouTube. You will thank us. Sergeant Slaughter. Nice guy. Had a chance to meet him. Next time I meet him, I'm going to get him to put me in the Cobra Clutch because I feel like it's worth it. I feel like I want him to have that extra $40.
Yeah, it's weird that they never explain, like, the Cobra thing or anything like that with him. And, because, like, it's not from G.I. Joe. Like, he had, like, this, like, Cobra Brigade or whatever. But I did watch that documentary as well, that biography. And for it being about a wrestler that is alive, it is very honest for that. Yeah. Normally, when the wrestler's still alive... They kiss that person's ass. They're all butterflies and snowflakes. They made every perfect decision correctly. They're heroes. But this one, you know, he gets very honest about, like, he destroyed his marriage. He destroyed his relationship with his children.
Yeah.
He had to take the money to go do G.I. Joe and leave wrestling. And he's not exactly sure if that was the right move for him. He opens up that, like, he never served in the Marines. He is not really a Marine. But Sergeant Slaughter was, his character was. And so because he's always in character when he's in public, he must keep that facade up. But he did acknowledge that he was wrong to start saying that he was a Vietnam veteran. And he has stopped doing that and has apologized for that.
Yeah, that part was really interesting. And we had kind of, like, I don't know, busted on him. It's maybe a little harsh, but we kind of gave him a little bit of shit before about, you know, stolen honor and that kind of thing. But his explanation that, like, you know, Bob Remus was never in the military, but Sergeant Slaughter was, right? And, like, he is, like, the oldest of old school guys where you were never out of character. And so if somebody asked him in a public setting, were you in the military? As Sergeant Slaughter, he would say, yes. Yes, I was. And I do think it's kind of like when he got specific about, like, oh, yeah, I did two tours in Vietnam and in specific years and that kind of stuff. That maybe crosses a line, especially for people who've served. I don't care necessarily one way or another, but I do understand where people are coming from there. So anyway, that another one of those things, Rich and I were texting back and forth about it. And it's another one of those things where it's just like, again, this is why wrestling is the best sport. You don't get to have these kinds of conversations about what is reality, you know, what is your public face, private identity, except for in this area.
Right. Like, your perception doesn't count in other sports. Your perception isn't important because there's a final score. Well, they won. They lost. But as we've seen and discussed in other matches and stuff like that on this show, there can be a person that wins by a pin, but they're not the winner of the circumstance.
Right.
And that's the beauty of professional wrestling.
Yeah. Anyway, well, let's check it out if you get a chance. We move on from this awful backstage segment. Everybody in that, maybe with the exception of Ted DiBiase, deserves better. Next up is the 31-man Andre the Giant Memorial Battle Royal for the Andre the Giant Memorial Trophy, I guess. We miss all of the introductions for this, thank God, except for the Big Show and Sheamus. So everybody else is already in the ring till we get there. I have no idea why it's 31 and not 30. I assume somebody was added.
Yeah, hurry up, throw them in to get the money.
Yeah, they need a payday. They need a payday as kids need new shoes. This is, you know, this is all the chaos you'd expect. It's kind of fun to see some of the faces here. I have the full list in the order that they're eliminated that I'll do at the end here. But did you see anything during this that you really enjoyed or anything you want to notice about it?
One, the magic of Kofi Kingston.
Holy shit. Holy shit.
Kofi gets thrown over the top rope in the corner. So he goes over top of the turnbuckle and the ring post and somehow adjusts his body to where he lands flat on his back on the floor, but his feet are resting on the ring steps. And so if you know the rules of a WWE Battle Royal, you have to go over the top rope and your feet must touch the floor. And his feet did not touch the floor. They landed on the steps. That does not count. And he somehow maneuvers himself back into a standing position without his feet touching the floor, back up onto the steps, and back into the ring.
It's insane. It is insane. Like, he flies so far up in the air and then down and lands completely flat on his back. And still, man, I wouldn't have maintained consciousness, let alone kept my feet in a particular place.
Right. Like, how does his head not bounce off the floor like that?
It's crazy. He gets back in and then gets caught in a big swing from Cesaro. And Jerry says, his children will be born dizzy, which made me laugh.
Yeah, that was funny. That was good. Classic Jerry Lawler.
Yeah. There's a baby Cody Rhodes. We get Mark Henry clotheslining two guys out at once. That was pretty cool. Yeah. There's a really like an interesting moment where Cody and Dustin like back into each other, and it's very subtle. They don't like make a big deal out of it, but he, you know, you would normally, if you back into somebody in a battle royal, you start fighting them, right? But he just kind of like pats him on the back. Cody pats Dustin on the back, and they just go back to fighting whoever they were. I thought that was kind of an interesting, like, way to keep the, like, the character, right? Like, not just get caught up in the moment.
Cody gets eliminated by Alberto Del Rio eventually. That dude, idiot Fandango, throws out my boy Big E, which broke my heart.
I thought he would hang in longer, actually.
Yeah, and there was an awesome spot, too, where Dolph Ziggler does the skin the cat maneuver to try and pull himself back into the ring. And halfway up, Alberto Del Rio, like, super kicks him right in the face upside down and sends Dolph out of the match, which I thought was a great spot. And then Sheamus and Del Rio, Big Show and Cesaro are the final four, and everyone's like, oh, well, there's nobody in that ring that can throw Big Show out.
Yeah.
And then Sheamus and Del Rio eliminate each other. So now it's just Cesaro and Big Show. So Cesaro's a decent-sized guy. I mean, if you ran into him on the street, you'd be like, that guy's a pro wrestler or a fighter or something.
He's like 6'6 or so. He's big, yeah.
But he's not Big Show.
No.
You know, he's not 7 foot and like 500 pounds. And so those two start going at it, and then out of nowhere, Cesaro just picks up Big Show, 7 foot tall, 500 pounds, high enough to put him over the top rope and throws him out, like definitively throws the Big Show out of the ring in possibly one of the most shocking battle royal finishes I've ever seen in my life.
No, yeah, it's not like, you know, usually if you get a big guy like that, you kind of like, they kind of push him over the ring a little bit, you know, over the rope a little bit. But he bodily picks him up and body slams him over the top rope. Like, that dude is insanely strong. I've heard other people say, apparently he's a big weightlifting guy, and he just works out, like, like nobody's business, and he can lift all kinds of crazy weight. Well, he puts his back into it and gets this one out.
Yeah, he lifted from the legs. He lifted from the legs, and
that's
boy,
that's the way you got to do it.
Whew, my God! And like Cesaro, like he's in really good shape. You look at him, and it's like the dude looks in shape, but he doesn't look that strong.
Yeah,
he doesn't look so strong that he could pick up Big Show like that, but he can.
He also looks like he's like 50 years old compared to everybody else in this match. So I always think he kind of looks like Stanley Tucci. So every time I see him, I'm like, oh, it's like athletic Stanley Tucci. Yeah.
I always think he's Jason Statham for some reason.
Yeah, I could see
that. That's where my brain always goes. Anyway, Cesaro wins the big trophy that's almost as big as him. And Big Show does give him a good handshake at the end. So there's some sportsmanship between them.
Yeah, if you're curious, I don't know why you would be, but the order of elimination from first to last for all 31 participants is Yoshitatsu, Brad Maddox, Brodus Clay, Great Khali, Zack Ryder, Darren Young, Drew McIntyre, Jinder Mahal, Heath Slater, Mark Henry, Titus O'Neil, The Miz, Santino Morello, Xavier Woods, Damian Sandow, Justin Gabriel, David Otunga, Big E, Fandango, R-Truth, Sin Cara, who, by the way, was Mystico in Mexico, came up as Sin Cara, and now he's in AEW as Mystico again. I have no idea if it's the same guy under the mask, but it's the same character. I have a Mystico story then sometime. Tyson Kidd, Goldust, Cody, Rey Mysterio, Kofi Kingston, Dolph Ziggler, Alberto Del Rio, Sheamus, and Big Show. That's the order. So, all right. Next up is maybe one of the best like video package / entrances thing I've seen in a long, long time. This one is John Cena versus Bray Wyatt, who has his family, his weird, creepy backwoods family, which is Eric Rowan and Luke Harper in his corner. We get a video package introducing the guys, and then we go to the entrance. And I know you really loved this. Do you want to talk about what happens?
Oh, my God. This entrance has been living rent-free in my head since I watched this. Like, so it starts out with some woman doing, I would say, Afro-Cuban Caribbean dancing with swords in front of what is very much like designed to look like a voodoo temple with just fire. So everything's naturally lit with just fires. And she finishes her little dance, and then we get a little like a static interruption and a video of Bray Wyatt lighting a lantern, and then his boys show up in the shadows behind him, and he just goes, "Nollins, we're here," and then blows out the lantern. And then Mark Crozer kicks in with his with the theme that he's using, Bray Wyatt's using at this point, Live in Fear. And so he's in like some sort of weird skeleton makeup just lit by fire. And then, and like the rest of the band is wearing like the bird shaped plague masks, like very steampunk kind of looking. And then Bray just shows up and just like creeps his way to the ring. And the way it's all lit is that you can't necessarily see that he's moving or walking, but he's moving closer to the ring. He gets to the ring, near outside the ring, and he sits down in a wooden rocking chair. And he starts rocking in it, and then the music cuts off right as he blows out the lantern, and then the arena lights come up. And it's just, and all you can hear is the announcers go, "Wow." It's a very intense moment. It's very subdued, though. Like the music is very like doesn't go anywhere really harmonically, and it just sits on the backbeat, and is this kind of creepy, ominous,
atmospheric,
yeah, kind of thing.
Yeah,
like the lyrics don't even matter. Whatever the hell he's singing, like it doesn't matter. It's just an intense moment that I gotta say, this is Bray Wyatt's first WrestleMania, and they're giving him a live band and an entrance like that.
Yeah.
Boy, they love you. They love you.
And yeah, so much time for that whole thing to spool out. And but it's not boring though. It's actually really well done. So I agree. It was really cool. I was kind of captivated by it. So the whole kind of story they're telling here is that Wyatt wants Cena to sort of finish him off in a really violent way and come over to the dark side and join his evil, creepy backwoods family, which carries around its own live band and rocking chair, I guess. My only criticism of that is that John Cena is like the consummate good guy, right? Like he's never even remotely considered being a bad guy. He's even when the people don't like him. So like, if you're going to try to work on somebody to get him to come to the dark side, I mean, maybe that's the natural choice because there's such an extreme, but maybe you find somebody who might be a little easier. Like Seth Rollins seems like a guy who could be tempted. Just saying.
They definitely love you if they're giving your first WrestleMania opponent's going to be John Cena and they give you a live band and all that time to enter. But I feel bad because Bray Wyatt is such an incredible storyteller with his presence and ring behavior and stuff like that. And I've just never found John Cena to be the same type of person to reciprocate that. Like I just don't get a story told from him except for the same thing every time. It's like, I don't want to lose. That's all I get from John Cena is I don't want to lose. And I think that's the reason why John Cena gets such a mixed pop. Like that arena is not happy with him. They kind of want Bray to win.
Yeah, he's the more compelling of the two for sure, right?
He tells the better story. He looks better. He's more cool, you know? And again, Bray Wyatt isn't your cookie cutter WWE wrestler. He's not the bodybuilder shape, you know, and tan like a butterball turkey. Like he's a dude. He's a big dude, but he's just a dude, you know? And
now I want turkey.
Yeah, I don't, but I just, you know, and I think, again, that's why the crowd is behind Bray Wyatt, not just, I mean, outside of the cool theatrics and the dude with the sheep mask, it's, you know, he just looks different. Yeah. He's something different.
He does. And he seems like he's physically strong while being emotionally vulnerable, right? Like,
yeah.
Which is an interesting combination. I will give John Cena props because he does a good job of this in this match of sort of like teetering on the edge of losing control and being a little more physical and aggressive than I think he usually is. You know, he was always much more kind of cartoonish in his ring work, you know, sort of Hulk Hogan-ish. But here he's kind of a little more violent that, you know, so it's not like it's a De Niro performance or anything, but he's trying, you know?
Yeah. I would argue that this is my favorite John Cena match. That because John Cena actually does do a little bit of storytelling here. He's pushing back. And it's another one of those moments where I just talked about where, sure, John Cena wins this match, but does he really win because of what he had to do to win?
Right.
So, you know, that's the best we can hope for out of John Cena.
So this match goes 22 minutes and it feels like it. Cena stops himself from crushing Bray Wyatt's skull with the ring steps. He does get the win, overcomes the big evil monster. I don't know. It's okay. It's not, the match itself isn't as good as the lead up to it, in my opinion.
Yeah. I mean, I like this match. It got me invested. The lead-in got me invested and stuff like that. Bray Wyatt's character is very similar to Mankind, and I always liked Mankind's character. I did notice that John Cena was wearing Hulk Hogan underwear. That was kind of sticking out through the top of his jean shorts. I guess they're called jorts, aren't they?
They are.
Cena is not a fan favorite in this. He's getting booed. It's kind of weird. Like, Bray is supposed to be the heel, but the crowd is not.
Yeah.
And there's multiple times during this match where Bray is screaming at John Cena to finish him. Like, starting right away, Bray Wyatt puts himself on his knees and is screaming at John Cena to come hurt him. It's great storytelling out of Bray Wyatt. It's the best of the storytelling that you're going to get out of John Cena. Bray Wyatt also has some unusual moves in this too, where like he does like what would be like a backbreaker, but has John Cena flipped over. And so his knee goes into the, like a gut buster, like his knee goes into the guy's gut. I felt that looked brutally painful. And then, like, there's the moment where, and the camera caught it perfectly, John Cena was about to drop for the five knuckle shuffle and suddenly notices that Bray isn't laying there, but Bray is actually, like, upside down in the ring on all fours, like his back arched with his, to the point of his hands on the mat as well, and like staring at him like a weird, like, fucking spider or something. Yeah. And, you know, and the ref is getting in on the storytelling too, because he recognizes John Cena's not good at storytelling. He keeps yelling at John Cena not to give in to the violence and stuff like that, but it's wrestling.
Yeah. That's the equivalent of voiceover narration, right? Like, that's when, yeah, when your story is kind of shitty and you have to, like, let the narrator tell people what they need to think.
There was an incredible moment where they're outside of the ring fighting, and they're about to go through the Spanish announce table, and you can see the Spanish announce team yelling for them to go over to the French table and pointing at the French table. So I thought that was pretty funny.
That's pretty good. I like
it. And then it finally happened. At the end of the match, Michael Cole, instead of saying Cena Nation, says C Nation. I was so happy, because that's what's actually printed on all the John Cena stuff, is is a portmanteau of Cena and Nation.
Right.
So it should be C Nation, but C-Nation. People always say Cena Nation. And then Cena hugs his dad after the match, because he didn't go to the dark side.
So somebody tweeted recently, I feel like it may have been Dax Harwood, that who is the better wrestler is not a story for a wrestling match, right? Like, and that's right. That's the problem with so much modern wrestling. The story, quote unquote, that they're trying to tell is who is the better wrestler, and can we have an amazing, by amazing they mean a match with all the moves and flips and 40 minutes of nonsense. But that's not a story. A story is, here's a monster from the backwoods of wherever, trying to appeal to our golden hero's basest instincts and turn him into another violent monster like himself. And your hero has to overcome it, or he has to succumb to it. That's an actual story. So I thought about that quote while I was watching this, actually. I'm like, yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Well, I mean, that's Hulk Hogan in a nutshell.
Right.
Hulk Hogan openly admits that he was not the best ring worker. But damn it, he knew how to tell a story in that ring. Even after a while, that story became identical. But, you know, it became a story. Like, he's either chopping down the giant, or he's met another man that's just as muscular and as forceful as him, or he's trying to defend his honor and prove that he wasn't moving in on the Macho Man's wife.
Even though, you know, he totally was.
Right, he totally was. You know, it's those kinds of stories that get told in the ring and are compelling, and is what gets the little kids screaming and what gets the people putting down money to buy your t-shirt, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Kenny Omega might be a good wrestler, but I don't think he tells good stories. And there's a reason why I have a Scott Hall t-shirt and a Ric Flair t-shirt and not a Kenny Omega t-shirt.
Yeah. There's no stories. Well, so speaking of the classics, we're up to the Hall of Fame section, which is always one of our favorites. We love getting to see the old guys. The class this time is Jake the Snake, who looks great. This is, if you've seen the little documentary about him kind of getting his shit back together with Diamond Dallas Page, this figures fairly large in that. In that story. So this is kind of a nice moment. Mr. T is there for the celebrity wing. Paul Bearer gets a posthumous induction. Paul Bearer's kids do a pretty good impression of him, I should say.
Yeah, that was pretty funny.
The Undertaker comes out and holds up the urn as a sort of tribute. Carlos Colon is inducted by his kid and a couple of others. His forehead is a freaking nightmare. Did you look at all the razor scars?
Oh, yeah. It's terrifying.
Sweet Jesus.
It's not as bad as Dusty Rhodes, no. But it's up there.
He's the Puerto Rican Dusty Rhodes. Lita gets inducted, maybe a little early, but who's going to quibble? Razor Ramon, speaking of Scott Hall, he's inducted by Kevin Nash. Scott Hall's induction speech is one of the all-timers for me. His line about bad times don't last, but bad guys do. What a great fucking line.
Yeah.
What a trick.
And he's in character, too. Like, that's not so how good. He normally talks. He's still talking like Razor Ramon. It's so amazing.
Yeah. And then the last one is the Ultimate Warrior, inducted by Linda McMahon. So we were just talking about before we hit record that this is his next to last public appearance. He did the Hall of Fame Saturday, he did WrestleMania Sunday, and he appeared on Raw the next night, and he died the night after that on Tuesday, which is strangely poetic in a way.
Yeah, because this was kind of like his resurrection. Like, well, the Jake the Snake documentary is literally called The Resurrection of Jake the Snake. The Ultimate Warrior getting inducted was pretty much an indicator that he had finally healed all the wounds that he had caused with the WWE in his past. Whether it was his work ethic, his substance abuse, like all of it combined. He was not a wrestler. That's one thing that people tend to forget, is that he was not a wrestler. He was a bodybuilder. And he just learned barely enough wrestling to get through, and all he cared about was storytelling and the popularity.
Yeah,
like he was Hulk Hogan to the extreme,
right?
He had kind of finally healed those wounds and got the Hall of Fame induction. I mean, I guess he deserves the Hall of Fame induction, even though he was this he was a bottle rocket.
Yeah,
you know, he was only there for like a year and a half. That's how short the Ultimate Warrior was there, but like it's so burned into the history because one, he was suddenly as big as Hulk Hogan and had a WrestleMania match against Hulk Hogan, which sometimes is good and sometimes was bad. It was a weird match, like two muscle guys just staring at each other a lot for a while. But you can't deny the effect that his popularity had. Like, it suddenly showed that someone else besides Hulk Hogan could be popular in pro wrestling.
Yeah, I think in terms of probably box office and maybe merch, you know, his influence was huge. And he, you know, he's kind of the, what do I want to say? He's kind of like the culmination of like Vince's aesthetic, right? Like, if Vince's aesthetic was that you just need a massive guy with a deep, deep tan to come out there and be very dramatic. Like, that's him, right? You don't have to have any wrestling ability. And, you know, people talk a lot of shit about him these days. And he sounds like he was not a great person to be around, especially in his heyday. But he was important to the business for however long it lasted, you know? So
yeah. And those psychotic promos that he always gave.
Oh, my God.
Like being on these different planes of existence and calling his ultimate maniacs and whatever, like, oh God, it's so crazy.
His warriors. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The one before the Hulk Hogan matches. Look that shit up on YouTube. You guys will love it.
Yeah. So,
anyway, he actually, by this point he had changed his name to Warrior too. Like officially he wasn't Jim Hellwig anymore. So,
yeah, and he was actually angry that he couldn't go by the Ultimate Warrior because WWF owned the rights to that name. And so when he left the WWF, he was angry that he couldn't use that name, so he just started going by Warrior.
Yeah.
And the only other note that I'll take from the Hall of Fame thing was that Howard Finkel still got the pipes.
Oh, my God, yeah.
Oh, that voice, man.
Mean Gene makes an appearance here, too. Is this where they show some of the other guys? They show Piper and Orndorff, is that
yeah
later?
They show them ringside,
yeah,
right after this. I think they show, and like Bret Hart is ringside, yep. And Harley Race is ringside,
and Dusty
and some other, yeah,
and Bruno Sammartino are all there.
Yeah,
so I can't believe that Bruno Sammartino is still walking around in 2014, but good for him.
Yeah, and able to get down to New Orleans.
All right, it's time for the main event here, for better or worse. Brock Lesnar with Paul Heyman versus The Undertaker.
This is not the main event, I should say.
I'm just saying, it's the main event.
It might as well have been.
It's the main event.
It's what everybody remembers from this show.
It's the psychological main event, I'm just going to say. So, you know, The Undertaker has been on a streak, 21 unbeaten WrestleMania appearances, going back to WrestleMania, WrestleMania 7, 8? 9, somewhere around there.
WrestleMania 8, I think, was him versus Jimmy Snuka.
He skipped a year. I do remember that.
Yeah, WrestleMania 10, I think.
Okay. So there's a really good promo for the streak, which I like. There's a row of coffins for all his former opponents, and they have his opponent's name on them. Except the only problem with it is, like, all of those guys are still alive except for King Kong Bundy. So he obviously didn't kill them. I know.
I thought it was also hilarious that they had two coffins for Shawn Michaels.
Fuck that guy. He should be dead twice.
Bury him twice.
Paul Heyman does a brilliant... A brilliant introduction. He introduces Brock and he gives a line about eat, sleep, conquer, repeat. And man, that guy, he's getting inducted in this year, and I know he's still active and he thinks he has more to do, but like, if anybody deserves to be in the Hall of Fame for sheer talent, it's Paul Heyman.
When this match was announced, watching the show, like, my stomach, like, sank to the floor immediately. And that brilliant Paul Heyman video promo, because, like, he's like, nobody can beat The Undertaker, you know, nobody. But then he's like, but Brock Lesnar, maybe. Oh, that delivery of the word maybe. Oh,
it's so good.
And then he has this other line that is, the affirmation he seeks is your contempt, your disgust, and your disdain.
Oh, man.
Oh. It's like, Shakespearean.
It's like he swallowed a thesaurus.
Right. It's Paul Heyman, and he's just winging it in that video, too. It's not like he sat down and wrote a script. He's just like, all right, I'm ready to go. Film me. Yeah. And he lands a line like that. Like,
yeah. That's crazy.
Yeah.
So Brock comes out. He looks great. He's huge. He's stripped down, you know, to just like the shorts. He's got to eat, sleep, conquer, repeat. He comes out and gets in the ring, and then the Undertaker comes out, and he looks fucking ridiculous. He's orange. He's got a dumb Liu Kang hat on from Mortal Kombat. He has an Aryan Nation haircut and way too much eyeliner. They get in the ring, and Brock tries to, like, look intimidated. He tries some acting, but it's not. I ain't buying it at all.
No.
I wrote down, I can't believe Undertaker did 6 more WrestleManias after this.
Yeah, so, like, Paul Heyman also walks out with Brock Lesnar, and he kind of also walks out strutting and acting tough, like he is as tough as Brock Lesnar, but just with wordsmithing instead of a physical presence.
He's tough by association, right?
Right, and Jimmy John's is still sponsoring Brock Lesnar at this point, you know?
I do enjoy their subs. Jimmy John's, call us.
And it is really... an interesting thing here, because the crowd is split. The crowd is very uncomfortable. The crowd, you can tell, is sensing something is up with this match. There's something that's about to change. Like, just something. I don't know if Bray Wyatt summoned some sort of spirit that like, you know. One, I don't think the Undertaker had actually fought a match since the previous WrestleMania at this point. He's only shown up at WrestleMania and maybe like the Raw and SmackDown before it. And he's not doing any action in them. And, you know, the crowd just gets this sense that, like, this is going to be elder abuse almost. You know, like, the Undertaker, this is it. Like... the crowd, they're in denial. They don't, like, the audience is in denial. And it's an amazing thing to witness as a wrestling fan, is to see a crowd that is in denial about what is possibly about to happen. Because this is the first opponent where nobody can see an outcome of the Undertaker winning.
Yeah.
Because all the Undertaker WrestleMania wins... most of the recent ones had been brutal, but he suddenly shows up dominant near the end and wins it. But in this match, they're like, how are you going to do that with Brock Lesnar? It doesn't, like, Brock Lesnar's character doesn't fit that mold.
You're never going to dominate him, right? You may beat him, but you're never going to dominate him. And that's the Undertaker's whole modus operandi, is he dominates whoever he goes up against. So, I think the crowd is... I wrote that they're dead, I think you're right. I don't know if it's that they're dead so much as just they're kind of waiting almost. They're sort of like, they're just apprehensive. But even when they go outside the ring, nobody really cares. Brock is sweating like Mike Rotunda throughout this thing. He is working his ass off. And the other guy working his ass off is Paul Heyman, who is, like, again, who is the Sherry Martel MVP of this match. Like, Sherry Martel's incarnation via Paul Heyman is, he's watching the action from outside. He's like looking under the ropes. He's watching it closely. He's grinning whenever Brock is on top, and he's yelling support. He looks concerned whenever the Undertaker gets a little bit of offense. He is like that dude, man. He is something else.
The crowd, there's a good number of signs in the crowd that are pro Brock Lesnar in this. There's people that want the Undertaker to lose in this match, and that's rare.
Yeah.
in these WrestleMania matches, to see anybody thinking that, like, the Undertaker is going to lose and wanting to see him lose.
Is this a smart fan switch, do you think?
I think part of that. I think this is the smart mark, you know, the people that are like, they're reading the tea leaves, you know. There might have been internet rumors out there at this point that the Undertaker was booked to lose. I think also people just saw the Undertaker. He came out and he looked frail.
He looks ridiculous, yeah.
He looks like he's 30 pounds lighter. He doesn't look as muscular. Not like he ever looked like a super muscular guy, but he looks trim. He looks fit. But he looks old. He moves old. And I think his TV appearances had been revealing that. And I think the crowd just, you know, they don't see a way for the Undertaker to win this match. It's not, you can't conceive him winning this match.
So he would have been 49 here, which is old.
It's very old for a pro wrestler.
Yeah, for sure.
They can sense that it's going to be brutal, and then that bell rings and Brock Lesnar is all over him, and I think the moment that first exchange happened, the crowd knew.
Yeah. It's like somehow you're watching a UFC fight, you're like, well, I know where this is going from the start, right? Like, one guy is mm-hmm. clearly outmatched. So Brock goes after the leg like he's at Thanksgiving dinner, and the Undertaker is the turkey. There's, you know, some impressive offense by Undertaker, I guess, you know, especially considering Brock's size. He does a pretty impressive choke slam at one point. He gets F5'd by Lesnar. There's a two count for that one. He tries his Hell's Gate submission hold, which I always thought was lame. The crowd really only gets up when Undertaker does his rope walk, but then Brock turns it into another F5, so it's cut off, like the legs are cut out from under it, like immediately.
The Undertaker's fighting from behind this entire match.
Yeah.
And you can't necessarily tell if he's fighting from behind because he's tired or because Brock Lesnar is this that much of a monster of a guy. And when Lesnar kicks out of a tombstone, that is the moment that the crowd is actually, you can hear a huge gasp from the 60,000 people in the Superdome and go, oh, this is it. this is it.
Yeah.
You know, Brock Lesnar kicking out of that tombstone, because it was, that tombstone was also led into with as much offense as the Undertaker could muster in this entire match. And it looked like a finish. And if that's not the finish, then...
Yeah, it goes last ride, tombstone pile driver, two count. And then, yeah, the crowd is you can tell. You can tell there's a switch there. And then Brock hits Undertaker with the third F5 of the night and gets just a plain old three count dead in the center of the ring to end the streak. There's a guy in the front row who goes, what? You can see him. You can see him on the video. That is the most authentic crowd reaction I've seen maybe in a long time. There's legitimate boos. There's just sort of stunned silence. Green shirt guy is there. He can't believe it.
They don't start Brock Lesnar's music right away either.
Yeah, it's great.
Which really adds to the moment of the air being sucked out of the Superdome. And you can... see the crowd like looking to the aisle into the stage to see if someone's going to come out and negate the finish for some reason. Like maybe we missed Brock Lesnar using brass knuckles, or maybe we missed Paul Heyman holding the leg down, or maybe we missed something. There has to be something that can negate this, and it's just a clean pin in the middle of the ring.
Yep.
Paul Heyman can't even believe it. the crowd doesn't know what to do. Nobody knows what to do.
There's a little bit of a bullshit chant, but that doesn't go very far because it's just like it's all the air is just sucked out of that stadium. Brock eventually makes his way out. The Undertaker is on its back in the center of the ring for a long, long time, just milking it, you know. And Michael Cole, God bless him, doesn't overdo it.
He doesn't step over it. He doesn't. It's amazing.
Yeah, he does a good job. I can't believe I'm going to say positive things about Michael Cole right now, but here it comes. Hit record on your podcast apps or whatever. He does this kind of hushed commentary, like if you were watching. I'm just going to use a football analogy. If you were watching like a major starting quarterback like get injured, right, and watching them help him off the field, and you know, kind of wondering, hoping he's, you know, he's just, you know, the Undertaker is just, you know, we can't really, you know, believe what's happened here, and you know, Brock Lesnar just pinned the Undertaker, and you know, Brett Favre, it looks like his leg might be, you know, really hurt. We're gonna hope the best for him. It's such a contrast to his usual bombastic nonsense that it's actually really striking. I'm like, well, maybe this guy is capable of learning. The scoreboard up top reads 21-1, which is just like the nail in the coffin, so to speak.
That's when the crowd actually fully reacts, is when that graphic pops up, the 21-1. That's when people are like, he really did lose, and they're not going to change it. Like, it's one of these fixed moments in time that, like, no matter what you do with your time machine, this is one of the moments you can't change because it alters everything after it, kind of like moments for these people. And there's people crying in the crowd.
I thought that was a little much, to be honest. Like,
these are the people. These are the people that pay the $1,500 to sit ringside. They're also the ones that are going to cry when the Undertaker loses.
It's a 49-year-old man who looks like a Thanksgiving turkey. Like,
right.
I think
that just got his ass beat by a guy 15 years younger than him.
Yeah.
That was a MMA champion and a NCAA world champion. And like, just if the Undertaker was going to ever have the streak broken, and I would argue that maybe he shouldn't have, Brock Lesnar had to be the one, because he's the only one that has the right type of character and demeanor to do it. Brock Lesnar didn't need that push, but I mean, that's going to be, you know, if they ever decide to forgive Brock Lesnar for his involvement with this Vince McMahon stuff, this is the moment that'll put him in the WWE Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
And, you know, in my opinion, this more cemented Paul Heyman's legacy than anything, because now Paul Heyman is the manager of the man beat the Undertaker at WrestleMania.
That's right.
He's the one that made it happen. You know, he's the one that, so like, he had the ECW stuff. So like, that's already like his mastermind. He's a, you know, and now he has been the manager of the Beast Incarnate that took out the Undertaker at WrestleMania. And now he's the wise advisor to the tribal chief, right? So like, it's this long ass storytelling of Paul Heyman's career, right? Paul Heyman was also the manager of the Samoan SWAT team, which became the Head Shrinkers when they came over to WWF. And so it's this long line, and those Samoans are Roman Reigns' like cousins. You know, so it's like this long, long running story.
Yeah.
And this is a moment more for Paul Heyman, in my opinion, that it cements him as the biggest heel, as he's the one that was able to take out the Undertaker streak, which at this point was more prestigious than the WWE title.
Yeah, for sure. So just for context, the last three before this, 2013, he fought CM Punk. Undertaker fought CM Punk and beat him. 2012, he beat Shawn Michaels. In 2011, he beat Triple H. So those are the three previous entries in the streak. And I don't know, the Shawn Michaels one maybe would have been a place to do it, but
It was Shawn Michaels' retirement match.
Yeah, so that wasn't going to happen there. Triple H was past his sell-by date by 2011, so it shouldn't have. Well, I mean, they both were, but it didn't make any sense for it to happen there. CM Punk, like you said, doesn't really have the right kind of character. I mean, maybe he could have done it like some sort of dirty way, but I don't think you want to wrap up a streak like that in that way. No. So anyway, yeah, I mean, I think there's people that have problems with ending it with Brock Lesnar, but I do think it, without rewriting a whole bunch of history, it was the right time and place to do it, you know? So maybe a little couple years too late, but
right. Like once you start drawing attention to it, you got to make sure you deal with it properly. Yeah. And that's another beautiful thing about professional wrestling is that those kinds of things end up mattering, you know? Yeah, the Patriots were a dynasty and they run all these Super Bowls, but it's not like, you know, it's not like the Undertaker streak where they have to now handle the storyline properly. although you said that the Undertaker was milking it in the ring, but Undertaker was actually severely concussed.
Oh, was he?
And he barely made it back down the ramp. So they show him limping all the way backstage, and he stops at the top of the stage and he doesn't do the fist thing, which he became known for doing, and he just walks through the curtain, and they pretty much immediately rush him to an ambulance to the hospital because he is in a concussion and doesn't know where he is.
Wow. Okay, that's not good. Well, I'm sorry I said I said he was milking it. Don't beat me
up.
It
looks like he's milking it. It definitely, like, he's selling it for sure, but it's also kind of real.
There's one really nice moment here. All the announcers stand and applaud as he makes his exit, and they are milking it for sure. But it adds to kind of the gravitas of the moment.
It feels like Undertaker's last match.
It does.
And it kind of feels like it should have been.
It does, for sure.
Like, that was not and I think the reason why is because he didn't perform very well in that match. And I think that's what kept him coming back. Like, if he felt like he had done a good job of putting Brock over, I think he would have been fine. But I don't think he felt that he did. And, you know, if you watch his old work and then you watch this, you know, even if you watch his match with CM Punk, his match with CM Punk is one of his best matches in the WrestleMania streak. So,
yeah. Brock Lesnar, you have to say, for all his pluses, he's not a guy that necessarily makes other people look great in the ring. unless by look great, you mean just like getting the shit beat out of him. So,
yeah.
So this WrestleMania has a problem now, because you've just sucked all of the air and enthusiasm out of your audience in the not quite the middle of the show, but you're in the last third of your show, and everybody has to sit there through a couple of more matches, and nobody is into it. The announcers aren't into it. The performers do their best, but the next thing up is a Vicky Guerrero invitational match for the WWE Divas Championship, and it almost feels like you're trying to give you a palate cleanser, right? This is the shot of lime after, like, the harshest tequila you've had in a long time. AJ Lee is the champ. This match also features, I guess we'll just use that word, Oksana, Alicia Fox, Brie Bella, Cameron, Emma, Eva Marie, Layla, Naomi, Natalia, Nikki Bella, Rosa Mendez, Summer Rae, and Tamina Snuka. So this happens. The Divas belt has a butterfly on it, and that looks cool. AJ Lee has had that belt for 290 days, which I guess is a record. Vicky is screeching. The girls do like four simultaneous suplexes.
I prefer suple in this.
I'm going suplexes. Yeah. Nobody gives a shit. The announcers are still talking about The Undertaker.
The crowd is booing through this entire match because I think they finally realized they just saw The Undertaker lose and they're not happy about it.
And now they got to sit there.
Right, and they got to sit there and watch a match with how many people in it? Like 10? But only four of them actually know how to work?
Yeah.
Yeah, and speaking of CM Punk, AJ Lee is CM Punk's wife.
Right. 15 people in this match, by the way.
Yeah, so 15 people in this match. Only 4 of them actually know how to wrestle, and that is AJ Lee, Naomi, Natalia, and Tamina Snuka, and maybe Layla. But yeah, that's it. That's it. Those are within 30 seconds of this match, those are the only 4 people that are doing anything. Everybody else is just kind of laying down, beat up.
AJ Lee wins, keeps her belt. Good for her.
Yeah.
There's a backstage with Mean Gene, Hulk Hogan, Piper, Paul Orndorff. I just wrote 3 or 4 of these guys are dead. 3 out of 4. And then Mr. T comes to the rescue. And then Pat Patterson in a ref outfit. So 4 out of 6 dead. There's the Hall of Famers at ringside that we mentioned earlier. Bruno. Oh, Bob Backlund. We didn't mention him before.
Yeah.
Harley Race, Dusty, and Brett. 3 out of 5.
And he's looking like a maniac.
He's always a maniac. God.
Paul Orndorff's mustache.
Oh, it's glorious.
Oh, my God. It is a work of art.
I got pregnant just looking at it.
Yeah. I would pay for a mustache ride for that.
He was such a man's man. I love Paul Orndorff so much. Like,
yeah.
He was probably, what, 60 here? I'll look it up while we're talking. But
probably at least.
Man, what a man. So, let's see. What else is left here? I guess we're at the last match.
We're at the last match. Oh, thank God.
Okay, Paul Orndorff was born in 1949. Minus 1949. 65.
Yeah.
So, anyway, any one of those 15 ladies in the last match would have gone home with him because he looks... So there's a live... Randy gets live theme music, too, with a band.
They're terrible.
This is terrible. It's an extended version, and it sucks.
Yeah.
The crowd still doesn't care. Batista also gets an entrance with, I think, the same band. I couldn't tell, though.
I don't know, but nobody cared about him either.
Nope.
But you know what finally woke this crowd up?
Let me guess.
Yes, 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 yes. That was it. That you just watched The Undertaker lose to Brock Lesnar, and nobody is getting a pop. Except for Daniel Bryan.
Yeah.
You know what you got to do now.
Yeah. Yeah, put that guy on everything. Mm-hmm. You got a match, you're going to put fucking Daniel Bryan in it.
Mm-hmm.
The action here is, you know, it's a typical kind of triple threat thing. I didn't take too many notes. I was bummed out and tired. Batista gets posted. Bryan dives on Steph, Triple H, and the ref at one point. That was kind of fun. Every time Daniel Bryan gets any kind of offense, the crowd loses its shit. They start chanting yes. They start putting up those signs. They start peeing on themselves. They're having a great time, at least.
Yeah, and since this is a triple threat match, it always ends up being one of those rotations, like people rotate in and out of the match. And anytime it was this Orton and Batista fighting, the crowd staring at their iPhones, wondering what time it is, looking around. Wondering if they should leave now to beat the traffic. And then Daniel Bryan shows back up in the ring and it's yes, 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 yes. Like insanity, like Pavlov's dogs. Like they're just going nuts the moment Daniel Bryan shows up.
Yeah. Like they were pumping the pumping the stadium full of helium whenever he came out. Let's see, Batista and Randy gang up on Bryan with the steps, with the monitor. There's a Batista bomb into an RKO on the Spanish announce table that gets a holy shit champ. That looked a little rough.
Yeah, Orton gets the worst end of that because he actually lands on top of one of those steel armored monitors. And it cuts the heck out of his back. Yeah. He is bleeding all over the place.
Yeah, he's all kinds of scratched up when he gets up.
Yeah.
There's a cool spot where Batista kind of leapfrogs Danielson. And then spears Orton in the corner, or maybe I have the people backwards, but somebody leapfrogs somebody and then spears the other guy. That I thought was kind of an interesting coordination.
And Daniel Bryan gets taken off in the stretcher after the spot on the table. But then he pulls a Mankind and gets off of the stretcher and charges back to the ring and gets back into the action. And then
what happens then? I don't know.
Bryan eventually gets Batista in the whatever crossface thing that he does, and Batista taps out. And so Bryan wins the championship without beating the champion, who was Orton. And so, yeah. And then we get announced that this is a Yeselmania by Jerry Lawler, which made me laugh.
That's a pretty good line. Yeah, I think this is really, this is the only possible ending that could have cleared out the post-Undertaker funk, you know, like, it's like somebody turned on a industrial-sized fan in Snoop Dogg's car, and you can just kind of see the clouds blow out the other side of the arena. But, yeah, it's a big deal, you know. I mean, good for Daniel Bryan, good for the fans who really kind of made that happen. I guess I understand that you want to end on a high note, right? But, like, man, I don't know that there's any way to have the streak end and then continue the event in a way that doesn't feel weird or awkward or like a downer, you know?
Yeah, and you also, though, can't just end the event with that either.
Right. You know? People killing themselves in the parking lot.
Right. People drinking themselves to death and then driving home.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's not going to be a good situation. And that's possibly a good argument for maybe they shouldn't have ended the streak. Let the Undertaker just take that one with him and then tell him, you're done. We're not going to book you anymore. It's time for you to take another role with the company or something, and then put him in the Hall of Fame the next year. But no, they can't do that. They can't. He because he is so important to the company, they just give him carte blanche and he can do whatever he wants. He never bounces back from this and he never looks the same. Once he loses the streak, he loses that last luster of invulnerability that his original gimmick had.
Yeah. The mystique is gone, right? I kind of wonder, you know, how much of that was his ego and how much of it was, like you said, he was an important sort of on screen character for them, but they could have found something else for him to do. You know, they could have turned him into the leader of some kind of faction or something, or like he probably wouldn't be cut out for a manager, but who knows, right? Maybe he comes out and
yeah, it's has tough being a manager when you're like bigger than 90% of the wrestlers, right?
Yeah.
This is a weird WrestleMania because this is a big change too, this WrestleMania.
Yeah.
We didn't mention it at the top, but the reason why the pay-per-view buys seem so low, as in almost half of the previous one, is that this was the first one to be live streamed with your WWE Network subscription. So this is right after they launched the WWE Network, where it was a $9.99 streaming platform instead of some sort of weird cable on-demand kind of thing. So the WWE Network is launched, and with that $9.99 a month, you get the live stream of all the pay-per-view matches. And eventually WWE dumps pay-per-view, and it's clear why, because by WrestleMania 31, the buy rate is only 259,000. So WrestleMania 29 had a buy rate of 1,048,000. This one had 690,000, so in half almost. And then it loses almost 60% by the next year, going to 259,000. And that's because why would you drop $50 on one event when $10 a month gets you all the events plus the entire back catalog?
Yeah. So to actually get the number of like paid viewers, we'd have to look up the number of WWE Network subscribers at this time. I kind of missed the network, actually. I liked the wrestling interface better than the Peacock.
Yes.
But, oh well, what can you do?
Yeah, I mean, Europe still has it for now, I think. I think they're about to get rid of it, though. The network in all total is about to disappear.
Well, we usually do best match and worst match and no shit moment. I think all three of those are are in that that Undertaker match. I don't know. It's not a very good match in and of itself, in my opinion. But it's also probably the best match on the card because the main event is a triple threat, which is not great. Everything else is kind of a throwaway. Maybe the Andre the Giant Battle Royal is best match just for that finish. I don't know, man.
You know, I would, for me, best match is probably Bray Wyatt versus John Cena.
That's
for
fair.
Me.
That's
I think fair. I think I enjoyed that one the most. I think that one had the most storytelling of the night. I mean, that's the issue with Brock Lesnar, the same as John Cena, is that they're not the best storytellers in the ring. They're, you know, they're just big guys that don't want to lose. And that doesn't tell a good story.
I don't know if it's worth picking a worse match here. Oh shit moment, other than Cesaro or Kofi?
You know, until we get to Undertaker losing to Brock Lesnar, it was Cesaro throwing Big Show over the top rope. If you want to disqualify Undertaker losing the streak, then it is Cesaro and Big Show. But I think that's where I lie.
Yeah. Yeah, that one and Kofi's spot kind of like neck and neck for me. I said, oh shit, both of those wins. So,
yeah.
But overall, I'm glad we watched it. It's a important one in sort of the history of WrestleMania. Even if it's not, you know, the most fun I've ever had watching a WrestleMania.
This WrestleMania also is really important because WWE claimed $10.9 million in ticket revenue, and New Orleans claimed to have $142.2 million economic impact from the event happening. And so this is when WrestleMania becomes like a Super Bowl and cities start putting in bids to get WrestleMania to come to them, because they can see at this point one night that is just a huge cash dump into the city's economy. And that's an incredible power. You know, that's Super Bowl levels of kind of stuff. That's the kind of stuff that starts triggering like human trafficking to
Jesus Christ.
to appease like certain CEOs of wrestling companies, right?
Got a little dark.
Look, it's Friday.
It's a Friday, man. Yeah.
Maybe. But yeah, that's the kind of thing that's happening now, is that the WWE is getting on that like mainstream level. Even during the Attitude Era, it was still kind of like an underground thing. And WWE's now at this point mainstream. John Cena's in movies, Roman Reigns, Rock, Stone Cold, Hulk Hogan, they've all done movies and TV shows. And I think at this point by now, John Cena's doing the Honda commercials, for Christ's sake. So, you know, WWE is a household thing. They had that movie, Fighting With My Family, around this point too, that really drew mainstream attention and did decent at the box office and had actual like named stars in it.
I like that movie.
Yeah. So, you know, they're becoming a cash cow, and it's big time.
They've gone from wrestling company to media conglomerate, you know, and it's in a whole other level at this point. So, yeah, so I'll be excited to check out WrestleMania 40. We'll bring you the WrestleMania 40 preview here in a week or so you can check out our picks for that. Anything else you want to say about this one before we do the in memoriam?
Yes, 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 yes. Actually, it's kind of tragic. A month after this, Daniel Bryan announces that he has suffered a neck injury and needs surgery, and they strip the title from him and take him off TV.
Maybe don't throw yourself around like a fucking rag doll. You'll be in better shape. I don't know.
Maybe.
Probably not. As we always do, we like to wrap up by just paying tribute to the men and women that we've seen in this WrestleMania who are no longer with us. So our in memoriam for WrestleMania 30 from April 6th, 2014 from New Orleans includes Bray Wyatt, a.k.a. Wyndham Rotunda, and Luke Harper, a.k.a. Jonathan Huber. Those were the active wrestlers that we saw here who aren't with us. But then we also have quite a few names from the Hall of Fame segment, including announcer Mean Gene Okerlund, ring announcer Howard Finkel, Scott Hall, Razor Ramon, Ultimate Warrior, I guess we should say Warrior at this point, Paul Bearer, Bill Moody, Roddy Piper, Paul Orndorff, Pat Patterson, Bruno San Martino, Harley Race, and Dusty Rhodes. All right, that's the Wrestling Archives for this episode. We thank you for joining us. We hope you check out our website at thewrestlingarchives.com. Check out our social media on Instagram and Facebook. Check us out at tpublic.com/thewrestlingarchives if you want to get one of our sweet, sweet t-shirts, which got a really super cool new design. You'll love it. You should check it out. If you want to help support the show, you can go to ko-fi.com/thewrestlingarchives and drop us the cost of a cup of coffee. We appreciate all your support. Otherwise, enjoy WrestleMania season. It's like Honda Days or Toyota-thon for wrestling fans. And we will see you next time.